Welcome to Iowa Health. I'm Jeremy Quinby. How are you, my friends? How's your summer going? It's good to be engaged with you all here again. I needed a break. I'm glad I actually did this for myself. The spring, between everything that happened with COVID, all the goings on in Minneapolis, trying to sort out what life's going to look like for the next year or so with my kids, my practice. It's been a lot to process, and it was just nice to take some time and kind of got lost in the summer just a little bit, at least for short bursts. So, you know, it was good. I think what basically happened by having that break, though, was that I just got down to the most essential things, trying to, you know, pay attention to Maslow's hierarchy of needs. You know, what I needed physiologically, safety-wise, and, you know, for my kids, my family, my mom, and kind of the emotional, psychological needs of support, friends and family. You know, I got to go on some bike rides with friends, walks at a distance, and spent some time swimming at a friend's pool. Lots of good stuff, you know, very, very essential pieces. Eating good food. It's a great time of year to dive into the food. Everything's fresh. So, you know, that was the most important thing I probably could have done right now, was just to give myself a little break. I had to prepare to get my practice up and running, figure out what makes sense for the next year with the potential at-home learning. And, you know, just trying to sort through everything. And after having a lot of conversations with Dr. Aaron Babb again, decided we're going to do a round two. So a lot of, you know, the everything changing day to day with information as far as what's happening with testing, potential with vaccines, understanding masks. I think there's still a lot of confusion out there. So we wanted to go through and sort through all this stuff and demystify and really kind of set up a structure so that you can maybe, if you're a person who tends to be anxious as I am, that you can kind of, you know, set some of those things aside and just focus on what makes sense. We're all going to be risk managing here. So the more we can really focus on what our own strategy is, the more that we can kind of, you know, get back to doing as much of what we want to do as possible. You know, we're all gonna have to make sacrifices here, but I think that's gonna be the theme right now. That conversation will be up in just a minute here. If this is your first time listening to the show, I want to welcome you. Highway to Health is a place for you to explore and create your own blueprint for health. Having worked in integrative health for more than 20 years, I'm acutely aware of how all aspects of our lives come to have an effect on our overall state of being. And it's my hope that through the content and conversations you get here, you'll become more engaged and empowered, both personally and in your communities. And I just want to say a quick thank you to all the continuing podcast supporters through our Patreon. If you'd like to donate and haven't yet, it's very easy. You can donate for as little as $1 a month. Go to patreon.com/highwaytohealth. And you can also click the support link in the show notes here. So we're going to jump right into the conversation here. This should help you kind of process some of what's going on. And we go pretty in depth. He even kind of explains really how this virus works, which I think is sort of helpful, you know, both to have a sense of, you know, the anatomy of transmission, and also, you know, start to develop some ways of strategy for yourself. So that, you know, if you know how this transmission happens, you can really protect yourself. It's not that challenging. And I have a lot of wild questions, which I kind of get into with him too, because there's a lot of stuff on the internet that I see popping up in various social media feeds, and I want to make sure that we dispel those rumors. So without further ado, here is my conversation with Dr. Aaron Babb. The reason I wanted to go through some of this with you again is because seems like there's a broad spectrum of folks where on one end, there are people who aren't worried about getting the virus or don't believe masks will prevent anything or simply don't want to wear them. And on the other end are the hypervigilant people who wash every package that comes through their door, disinfect each item individually from the grocery store, even change their clothes and disinfect their shoes before entering the house. But I think if we can understand how the virus is transmitted, we'll be able to move through this time period with less fear and a more science-based strategy that doesn't overwhelm us.
You know what? I've seen both sides of that extreme, exactly what you're talking about. Yeah. I've seen people who, you know, have made a big deal about even wearing a mask, like in the clinic to see me. And definitely, you know, people not wanting to wear masks or just taking, you know, any risk going into stores and just, you know, conspiracy theories, all sorts of stuff. And then I've seen, you know, the exact opposite, where I have some patients who are so worried about their family members, which, you know, I totally respect this. You know, I think in some ways, maybe it's a little overkill, but, you know, how can you be too cautious? But they, you know, they have family members who are at risk at home. And so they will go to the grocery store or go shopping, that sort of thing. They'll come home and then they will change their clothes before they go inside and put their clothes into the washer right away.
Yep.
And wash the bag, you know, and wipe down all the bags and every single item that they got at the store. You know, and so, you know, especially when you're thinking about like what happened at the beginning, you know, and how, you know, this thing was spreading so quickly and we had no idea how, you know, how deadly it was. It's hard to blame, you know, some of these people for being so overprotective. And I can't say it's
so much misinformation.
Oh, completely.
Just in general.
You know, yeah, exactly. And so, you know, so there are definitely both of those extremes. You know, so one thing I wanted to talk about, because I misspoke at the end of our last podcast where I wasn't quite very clear on the whole mask thing. So I just wanted to kind of go over that again. And
that's a good place to start. Yeah, let's do it.
Yeah, you know, and especially like in a little more detail about the different masks and that sort of thing, because we have, you know, we have better data on it, and also just a little more common sense type of information. So, you know, there's all sorts of different masks out there. And honestly, probably wearing the mask is the most important thing that we can do. I mean, mask, washing your hands, and social distancing. Those are like really the three main things still.
Yeah.
And so masks are super important. And, you know, you don't really need to have, you know, like a high-end N95 mask. Those ones are really only needed for the, you know, medical providers who are providing, you know, direct care with people who are positive, or if you're, you know, doing the swab tests and you think you could be exposed. So for most people, you really don't need to have like an N95 mask. You really just need a cloth mask or a surgical mask.
Yeah.
And, you know, now that, you know, production is back up, and they're a lot easier to find, and a lot of people are even just making them for their community. And you don't really need to have anything special, just basically something that's covering, you know, really covering your nose and your mouth. Another thing that I see often is that people have the mask on, but it's like over their chin, you know. So,
right. The chin strap.
Yeah, exactly. You know, or it's not over their nose and their mouth.
Right.
And so especially, you know, going into a crowded place, going into a store, you know, or into work where there's a lot of people, it's super important to wear a mask. And although the surgical mask and the cloth mask, you know, this is kind of where I misspoke, and I just want to be really clear about it.
Yeah.
So in all reality, when you're wearing a mask, you're really kind of protecting the people around you.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? But at the same time, yes, you are still protecting yourself as well, you know, from anything incoming. For the most part, the biggest thing is that you're protecting the people around you. So that's the whole reason why we all need to be wearing masks, so we can get through this together.
Yeah.
And that's why if you don't want to wear a mask, like I was saying last time, and I've said a couple of times in our meetings here at work, you know, if you, you know, think this is a conspiracy, or you, you know, you just don't think it's that big of a deal, or you think your immune system is able to, you know, fight it off, and it's not going to be a big deal for you, you know, just try to think about someone in your family, think about someone you love that you wouldn't want to get this. And so if you can do it for someone else, then do it for someone else, so we can all kind of get through this together.
Yeah.
I think that's super important. And then the last thing about the mask. Yeah. So the last thing I wanted to say about the mask is that I've seen a lot of people wearing these masks with one-way valves. And so those really should not be wearing. And the reason why is because so a lot of those masks are actually made for, you know, people who are working in construction or, you know, around toxic chemicals, that sort of thing. So the way they work is the person can breathe in, but when they breathe out, the valve opens. So if you're so if you possibly could have, be infected and you're around people and you take a breath out, then you would basically be expelling, the virus. And so the ones with the valves, really, you should not be using.
Yeah. And if, I don't know if anybody has seen, and maybe I'll post this, because there are some there are some videos now that basically show the difference between, what happens as far as, the different particles that come out of your mouth when you have a mask on versus when you don't. I don't know if it's like infrared or what it is, but it's probably heat, and then you can just see particles sort of shooting out. And so, getting into that, I think, I don't know exactly where we're at as far as like the true data on this, but it's, right now, from what I've seen, they've said about 80%, we bring the risk factor down to, about 80%. It's 80% effective, I should say, not down to 80% for if both parties have masks on.
And, yes, that's about the numbers that I've seen as well.
Right. So, and part of the reason that I also wanted to go through all this, as we were sort of talking about after our last podcast, was that if we're going to be in this for another 12 months, let's just assume, I think we, there's a lot of people who have this sort of rosy vision of we're going to get this under control and be done. Not the way the U.S. is dealing with it. I'm sad to say, really.
I totally agree.
I'm talking to friends right now in Germany and Belgium, and everybody's like, is it really as bad over there as they say? And I'm like, yeah, it's terrible. And they got hit hard at the beginning. And, they have very few cases, and they're just tracing better than they were right from the beginning. And they're smaller countries, and they're smaller size wise. So it's like a little bit easier to contain that way too.
Yeah. And, especially Germany did a really great job of flattening the curve and also reducing their death rate. So much of that has to do with, they're very good about, their culture is very good about, say, following directions and being kind of, engineer minded, but also, they don't have a fully nationalized healthcare system. They kind of have a two-tiered system, but still they're able to, and the other thing actually I read about Germany is that they were prepared for a pandemic. There were certain countries that basically knew something was going to come, at some point. And so they were better prepared. And Germany was one of those countries that already had kind of backup ventilators and backup PPE, and they already kind of had plans in place. So I think, they still are one of the countries that we should probably be looking at for, future planning.
Yeah.
But to go back to what you were saying about, this is going to last another year. Absolutely. I think this is super important for people to understand, because I feel like this kind of like start and stop and like, oh, it's going to be done soon type of, mentality that we've been going through the last, like 4 months, I think is really bad on people's mental health and having, basically kind of a general understanding and a realistic understanding of the timeline here. I mean, they keep talking about, and we can get into this later, but they keep talking about, the vaccine might be coming by the end of the year, all those types of things. But really, I mean, it's this thing is probably not going to be over until probably this time next year, when people can really get back to most of their, activities of daily living type of stuff.
Yeah. And as things are progressing, week to week, day to day, we're getting, things are changing all the time. So I'm sure you're having to adapt to this stuff. But now we're starting, I feel like we're, since I talked to you last, which was, I think maybe the end of May, something like that. There's just so much more information, and so many more things starting to progress. So with vaccines, we know there's this big trial that's about to happen in the U.S., right? It's like 30,000 people they're planning, something like that.
Yeah, so they just started actually. So there's multiple vaccine candidates across the world. China has multiple. The United States has multiple. So the first one from this company, Moderna, which is like this mRNA vaccine that we can get into if you want to. And so they just started their phase three trials with 30,000 people. And then the one from Oxford, I think, also has started doing phase three trials, which basically means that they've gone through the safety profile and basically shown that, in humans, it does show an antibody response and it seems to be safe in a certain number of people. And so this phase three basically means it's safe, and now they're trying to see, you know, how well and how effective it will be.
Yeah. And so explain the mRNA. mRNA, do I have it right?
That's right, yes.
It's not NRA. mRNA test. Explain that. I mean, how is that different from other vaccine tests or from other vaccines?
Yeah, so this is really interesting. And it actually acts in a very similar way to a virus. So basically, you know, a virus is not living. A virus is really just RNA strands, mm-hmm. and it can't live unless it basically gets into a host cell,
yeah.
and then takes over that cell to basically do the task that it wants the cell to do, so then it can propagate.
Right.
So basically, a virus will attach to the outside of a cell. And the interesting thing is the way that this virus attaches to the cell is it actually goes through the same receptors as a lot of the blood pressure medications that we use, these ACE2 inhibitors. Yeah, it's kind of interesting. So at the beginning, you know, we weren't sure whether or not people should continue taking their blood pressure medications or whether it would make it worse. Turns out it's actually a good thing for them to continue to take those.
Okay.
And so the virus will attach to a receptor on the outside of the cell, and it will get into the cell and then into the nucleus where the DNA is.
Yeah.
So then basically the virus will basically get incorporated into the DNA of the cell. And then it will basically tell the DNA what proteins to make, and then usually like for the cell to replicate, so then, you know, more and more virus can basically happen. So the mRNA vaccine basically happens very similar. So basically the mRNA vaccine will get into the cell, get into the nucleus, and get incorporated into the DNA, and then basically tell the DNA to produce certain antibodies against the virus.
Gotcha. Okay.
And so this type of vaccine has never, they've been working on these types of vaccines, I guess, for a long time, and I'm no expert at all. You know, basically I kind of have a surface understanding as I'm trying to take in, you know, information about all this stuff. So in no way am I a virologist
or know
everything about it, but at the same time, you know, they've been trying to get these vaccines to work, and it hasn't yet. And so it will be really interesting whether or not this one works and for how long, you know, if people are immune with it, how long it will last.
Yeah. But it's, I think it's actually going to be important for you to understand this to a certain extent, to like, you know, convince your patients like with that, that podcast that I sent you up from the Daily that was basically saying that only about half of doctors are you know, comfortable if we have a vaccine ready by the end of the year.
And I listened to that too. And so they were basically saying they did a poll, and I think less than 50% of the people who were asked on the poll that they would definitely take the vaccine. The majority of people were a suspect, which I mean, I can't blame a lot of people about it, because there's, you know, one, there's just so much misinformation about vaccines out there, and, you know, like the anti-vax and all that type of stuff. That's right. One thing. But the other thing is that when you think about it, most vaccines take like 10 years to develop, and they do like tons of studies on it. And this one is being pushed through so quickly. And so I understand people's, you know, trepidation about, you know, volunteering or wanting to get it done right away, those types of things.
And physicians, you know, being hesitant because, you know, obviously they want to make the right call with their patients too.
Absolutely. I mean, I'm totally in the same boat. And so especially with this one, I would have a hard time, at least right now, who knows, maybe over the next 6 months, they'll have like really compelling data and, you know, we'll be able to trust, you know, things a little bit more. But, you know, especially with how I just explained that and how it works. I mean, imagine, you know, having a vaccine like that, basically getting incorporated into your DNA to kind of tell your cells what to produce. I don't know. It's a little hard for me to think that I'm going to tell every single one of my patients that it would be a good idea for them to get it. You know, that's kind of how I do a lot of things where I'm not 100% convinced that it's great for everyone. I really try to make a per patient, like an individualized recommendation, you know, for all sorts of things, you know, for breast cancer screening, colon cancer screening, other vaccines, you know, I try not to basically just make a blanket statement and say everyone should get this.
Right, because you're this age, you should do this, or, you know.
Exactly. You know, and there are, you know, recommendations, you know, from, you know, from different organizations and groups of doctors and governmental bodies. And so I do follow all of that, but at the same time, I really try to give people individualized recommendations. And so for this, you know, I think I'll probably do the same until we're really convinced that the vaccines are, you know, effective and really safe and they don't have, you know, any significant side effects that we would be worried about.
Yeah. So can we talk about the antibody test? Because I feel like that's also something that's, you know, changing, you know, as we speak. I know there are tests now that are much faster. And obviously not every clinic's going to have access to them, but so where are we at as far as you know, the speed at this point? Let's just start there. I have a couple other questions after that.
Yeah, for sure. So as far as the antibody testing, to be honest with you, we really have not been recommending people get the antibody testing.
Okay.
Still, just because we don't necessarily know the utility of it yet. You know, it seems like, you know, people's antibodies are waning after about 2 to 3 months. It seems like they're not even testing positive anymore after that.
Okay.
And we're not really sure even how well the antibody testing is, you know, is clinically relevant. So, but the other testing, you know, we still use, and I think it is more interesting. So, the PCR test, which is a little complicated, but basically what it is that's where you do the nasal swab, and they're essentially looking for, you know, fragments of the virus or mm-hmm. fragments of that RNA.
Yeah.
And so the thing that's interesting about it is that people are still testing positive on the, you know, on the PCR, actually even sometimes a couple months later, even though they don't even, you know, they have less symptoms. And so that's where the Koreans thought that maybe people were getting secondary infections.
Yeah.
But actually, it was just like these viral particles that were like basically the body was continuing to shed them or continuing to basically break these viral particles down. So people were testing positive. But the more interesting thing is that it's starting to become pretty evident that people are most infectious the day before their symptoms start and the day of their symptoms.
Okay.
So, I mean, I feel like this is super important.
I think so, yeah.
I feel like I need to say this a couple of times because, you know, we've been talking about this in our meetings, but at the same time, I feel like it hasn't really kind of gotten through to everyone. So mm-hmm. when you really think about that, so think about like a virus and a viral disorder or a viral disease that can spread super quickly. And basically people can be shedding it or like be spreading it to other people and not even know that they're infected.
Is that so pretty standard with viruses, do you think, with just in common colds, that timeline?
You know, to be honest with you, not in my experience.
Okay.
And I was talking to a colleague about this, even with like influenza, you know, and there's been so much confusion with, you know, the flu, you know, the influenza virus and this and so much confusion. So I won't get into that too much. But really, from what I've seen, people who test positive for influenza really are most infectious usually the day, you know, the day of their symptoms they can be infectious the day before, because basically what happens when a virus gets into your system, you know, and it's infecting your cells, sometimes it takes your body a little bit of time to even recognize that there's an infection going on and also to mount a response enough once the virus starts to kind of taking hold.
Yeah.
And like, so a good example is actually cold sores. You know, and so I get cold sores. I mean, like 90% of the adult U.S. population, you know, if you test their antibodies to herpes, you know, HSV-1, almost everyone has been exposed.
Yeah.
But what happens with cold sores is oftentimes, like, you'll get a little, you know, like burning sensation, like around your lips before it happens.
Yeah.
And even though you don't necessarily, you know, have any lesions or anything like that, you technically can still be spreading it. So a lot of, you know, so it is possible that, you know, viral infections can spread to other people like the day before your symptoms or a little before. So they're calling that pre-symptomatic.
Okay.
So both people who are pre-symptomatic and also asymptomatic can spread the, you know, spread the coronavirus. So that's why it's so important for people to wear masks. And it's also why, you know, the whole testing thing has become very challenging because, like, for example, today, I had a lady that I, you know, did the swab on, and it's taking like up to 7 to 10 days for us to get those tests back. And so by that time, I mean, she's way past, you know, the time when she's most infectious. And so that, so although it's super important for us to know who's positive and that sort of thing, basically whenever I test someone, I'm always telling them, okay, you have to self-isolate. You have to assume that you're positive until we call you and tell you you're negative.
Okay.
Because that's really the only way we can do that.
So in lieu of in-person testing, is there a protocol now, like including, because I know you're still directing the telehealth at the hospital? So is how much of that are you using as it relates to potential cases?
Actually, you know what? We have not been, we really haven't been using that too much at all for potential cases. The way that we're doing it, at least at the clinic, is that, you know, when people call in and they possibly have, you know, COVID symptoms, I created kind of like this phone checklist for the medical assistants and the nurses to basically kind of do this, almost like this algorithm, you know, so they have, if they have these certain symptoms, you know, then they'll get a, then they'll have a parking lot visit with one of us. You know, and then we'll just do the testing there, like in the parking lot.
Yeah.
And then, so then to go back to the testing, so that's the PCR testing, and that's kind of the gold standard, really, to basically see whether or not someone's positive. But I recently was watching this video from this virologist from Harvard, and it was fascinating because it really kind of changed my thought process and opinion, and so on some of these other tests that are coming out that are. Can be done in like 10 minutes. And, you know, they're not quite as sensitive. So without getting too far into statistics, you know, when people talk about sensitivity, they're basically saying, okay, if you do this test, how many of the people who are actually positive will you basically catch? Mm-hmm. So if someone, you know, if someone says that, oh, this test is 90% sensitive, that means that, you know, out of 10 people who are totally positive, it will pick up 9 out of 10 of them. And so, you know, usually we're looking at trying to get a test that basically is 100% sensitive and then also 100% specific. So if something is specific, that means that if it's negative, you know, it's negative. So a lot of these tests really are maybe in the 70 to 80%, even the PCR ones. So we all, you know, we definitely still are missing some, you know, people who come back negative and they probably had it.
Yeah.
But the reason why this video from this virologist from Harvard kind of changed my opinion. So he was talking about these at-home tests, and they're actually monoclonal antibody paper tests. So you basically have this little kit at home, and you can change the paper every single day. And the paper basically has this monoclonal antibody on it, and it can basically it will light up if there's enough viral particles on it. And so, but those tests are only like in the 50% range.
Yeah.
So basically, you know, picking up half of the people. But, you know, the way that he kind of explained everything and kind of showed actually how, like, the people that they're picking up is actually the 50% of the people who are actually most infectious, because it's almost kind of based on viral load.
Ah, interesting.
And so it almost picks up, you know, like the 50% of people who would be most likely to be spreading it. And so, so they were talking about this could be a way of getting, you know, kids back to school more safely, is if, and like the cost of these, I guess, are much lower. And I guess the paper, he wasn't really like promoting any specific company or anything, but basically he was saying that, you know, you could almost do a test for about $1 a day. So then so if each family, say, had this kit at home, and you could basically test everyone every morning, and then if they're negative, they go to school, and if they're positive, then basically they go to the doctor and have the PCR confirmatory test. That would be a way of basically kind of getting society back to, you know, working order and be a little bit safer, you know, because of this timing thing, you know, when, especially with people who say, you know, might have been exposed, don't really have a ton of symptoms. You don't necessarily know if they could be spreading it. And if I tell them a week later, oh, you're positive, and they didn't really take it too seriously, they easily could have, you know, spread it to a ton of people.
Yeah, that makes so much sense, because so basically, you know, if there's like a 2-day window where we're more likely to spread it, and you can test and probably pick up 50% of those people who are most infectious, right? Isn't that kind of the way that test would probably be able to, you know, the information that you'd get from that test?
Exactly.
That's so that's dealing with like the biggest spreaders. So the question I have is, so how, if it's that cheap, what is that, like, does that mean that there's stockpiles of this that we can actually, you know, have access to?
Because that would be the big question. And I don't think that they have ramped up, you know, manufacturing of them. And we've even tried, you know, our clinic has been trying to contact some of these manufacturers, and they have not been able to acquire any of these testing materials yet.
Okay.
Yeah. And so it's been challenging. Even like the Abbott one, which I think Abbott's, their headquarters is there in Minneapolis.
Yeah.
But I think one of theirs is actually, you know, one of these immediate, you know, 10-minute tests that I don't think they have it set up that you could do it at home, but that you can do it in the office. And so I think that's one of the ones that we've been looking at, but they haven't even, I don't think they've even like returned phone calls because they're so busy. Everyone wants, you know, these testing materials.
Yeah. Because you guys probably are going to want them as, you know, as health professionals too, just because there are going to be times where you're like, is this allergy? Should I be working today? Right?
Oh my gosh, for sure. And I was telling you, I mean, that's why I wanted to do the podcast this week instead of last week, because I was, you know, the allergies up here is pretty insane.
Yeah, we got hit last week too.
Yeah, it's just crazy because so many of the symptoms, you know, the coronavirus is so similar to other viral infections, to allergies, to bacterial sinus infections, all sorts of stuff. And so there's so much overlap. Yeah. And you don't really necessarily know, like even the temperature thing. So every day, you know, when we walk in, we have to answer this little questionnaire and do your temperature. But even that's not that great of a test.
Yeah.
You know, there are some people who are advocating actually just checking your oxygen levels, you know, with one of a pulse oximeter that, you know, sees what's your oxygen saturation, which I think is kind of interesting.
Is that a finger? Because, I mean,
yep, yep. Okay. Yeah, just a finger probe. Yep, and you can buy them on Amazon for like $20-$30.
Huh.
Yeah. And so because your oxygen levels will go down even before you, you know, start having the shortness of breath and that sort of thing. I mean, I don't think it would be that great to be able to say, you know, be able to screen and pick people up. But for us healthcare workers, I've been trying to get people to do that more often.
And for, you know, at-risk population, I mean, as you know, my wife's aunt just died yesterday, COVID. And it, you know, from the sounds of it, she basically waited too long to go in.
Right. Right.
And so, you know, it's one of those things where if, you know, and sometimes it's like, you gotta, it takes some convincing, like I think her daughter had to convince her to go into the hospital, you know? And so, you know, if you were able for $20 to do a test and say, your oxygen levels are low, you gotta go deal with this. You gotta go have somebody check this out much sooner, exactly. You know?
Well, and especially for people who, you know, are at risk too. And so so this is another interesting thing that I wanted to talk about. So at first we assumed that people with pulmonary disorders such as asthma, COPD, lung cancer, that sort of thing, would be much higher risk of getting the coronavirus and having bad outcomes.
Yeah.
But actually there's been some studies recently, and that's actually not the case. So we don't know 100% why, you know, people with asthma and COPD are not getting the coronavirus as often as we thought they would. But the theory is basically these people are using inhaled steroids every day to basically keep their symptoms at bay.
Yeah.
So the theory is basically that by doing that, you're actually, you know, somewhat preventing, you know, viral infections, which actually kind of makes sense because they're starting to use study inhaled corticosteroids in hospitalized patients. So this is really interesting. There's been a lot of controversy about steroids too, you know, and because at the beginning they thought if you used, you know, NSAIDs like ibuprofen and steroids,
that
would have worse outcomes.
Yeah.
So that's still kind of the recommendation, at least that's what I'm following, is basically people early in, you know, people early in the disease pattern, you really kind of want to let their own immune system try to fight off the infection. Because a lot of people, you know, do become asymptomatic and kind of keep the virus at bay.
Yeah.
But if, you know, people start getting sicker and sicker, a lot of that sickness too is your immune system going crazy trying to fight this off.
Yeah.
And so they, you know, that's when the UK researchers started using dexamethasone, that's the steroid in hospitalized patients. And really that's still only recommended for people who are on a ventilator or on oxygen in the hospital. And so So it seems like some of, and then the inhaled corticosteroids in addition to that seem to be helpful in hospitalized patients. But, you know, one of the challenging things, like you were talking about with Lisa's aunt, is that we don't have a ton of great treatments, say, for people who are not sick enough to be in the hospital. Right. And we haven't really been talking enough about how to, you know, increase your immune system.
Yeah.
You know, the one thing, you know, the whole vitamin D thing, actually, there's been multiple studies since we last talked, and that is totally true. I mean, if there's one thing that, there's multiple things that people can do to prevent, you know, getting the coronavirus. Obviously, the staying home and masks and washing hands and social distance is one. And then the basics, of course, basically getting enough sleep and eating well,
exercising, moving.
Oh, absolutely. Getting exercise and that sort of thing. But the other thing is getting, you know, is taking vitamin D, because the majority of people in our country are, you know, are vitamin D deficient. And it seems like people with low vitamin D levels are having worse outcomes and contracting the virus more often. So that's one. You know, the other kind of newer one that I heard about or that I was reading about is this N-acetylcysteine. So it's another supplement. And actually, I just got some off Amazon that I'm going to start taking too. But it actually increases your glutathione level. So it basically helps your immune system. And they're starting to use that in hospitalized patients as well. So, okay. You know, there are a few things, but it's kind of frustrating that there aren't more, you know, treatments that we can recommend, or at least, you know, prescribe to people who are positive, who are having symptoms, but actually aren't sick enough to be going into the hospital.
So for vitamin D, is there anything that you recommend? I mean, are you able to recommend anything specifically vitamin D wise? Is there any pharmaceutical grade thing or any combination with vitamin D that makes it more effective?
Yeah, you know, it's hard, especially like on these podcasts and stuff. I really should be more careful.
Yeah, yeah.
You kind of what
you can
say,
be general, so, okay. Obviously,
yeah,
but.
So
But what you tend to do in your practice, I mean, you have to have these conversations, yes. I'm sure, sometimes.
Absolutely. And, you know, so the interesting thing is I should look on the map to see, you know, what latitude we're at compared to where you are, too. But, like, we're so far in the northern latitude that, you know, when I first got here, I was checking vitamin D levels on a lot of people. And every single person up here is low because we live so far in the northern latitude.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I recommend to almost all of my patients to take 5,000 units of vitamin D3. And then if you take it with vitamin K2, supposedly it gets incorporated better and you can use it more effectively. You know, that's actually a higher dose than is recommended by, you know, different organizations, that sort of thing. But because we live so far in the northern latitude, it's actually, even with that high amount of vitamin D, even when I recheck people, you know, 3-6 months later, it's still on the lower end. And so, you know, for example, just my own personal, every day I take 10,000 units of vitamin D3 with, I can't remember how much K2 is in it, but I think 100 milligrams of vitamin K2 with it.
Yeah. And I think, you know, that it's one of those things that you could probably talk to your own doctor or talk to a naturopath, depending on what, you know, what your climate zone is, to figure out what the right amount is for you too, I'm sure.
Absolutely.
Yeah. There's one other thing I was going to ask about vitamin D, but I'm totally blocking. But, you know, I think the one thing that we do have going for us right now is that it's summer. And, you know, is that this is going to become even more important as we sort of, as the sun starts going away in the northern hemisphere. So, I mean, I'm already thinking about that. I mean, I've been spending so much time outside and, you know, partly, you know, as a camp counselor for my children, trying to keep them entertained, you know, and some part of the day, I usually sort of block off the end of my day so we can go do something outside. We've been going to the, luckily we live 5 blocks from a lake and we can bike over there and swim and just take, you know, little bike trips and have snacks and stuff like that. So we managed to be outside in the sun pretty much, you know, at some point every day. But it's going to become hard here. And I mean, that's one of the things I'm starting to think about. And you know, that's, you know, part of the reason I wanted to do this is because I feel like there's a certain amount of preparation I can already feel myself trying to do, you know, just to start organizing for, you know, like I said, it looks like, you know, the order is going to come through tomorrow from Minneapolis Public Schools as to, you know, what's going to happen with learning. And it looks pretty much like we're starting the year at home. So, and if that's the case for the whole year, I feel like I have to almost kind of think about like a whole schedule for, you know, ways to kind of keep doing some of the same things that I've been doing right now.
Absolutely. That's super important. Yeah, it seems like there's probably a seasonal pattern to the virus, but even if there isn't, you know, just looking at human behavior, basically people being outside, it does seem to be, you know, safer to be outside. It doesn't seem like it spreads as easy. But so as we go into the fall, into the winter, not only could there be a seasonal pattern, meaning that the virus is more likely to, you know, be spreading in, you know, cooler climates, but people are staying inside a whole lot more, exactly what you were saying. And the other thing that we need to be aware of, too, is that still the most common place where this is spreading is in people's homes.
Yeah.
People's homes and social gatherings. And so, you know, being able to, you know, set up, you know, safeguards, especially if, say, someone gets exposed and trying to have a family member self-isolate at home, you know, thinking through that would be really smart.
Yeah.
You know, and how you can, you know, keep the other family members safe in case someone is exposed or is positive.
That's a good thought.
Yeah. So I think that's super important. And then also exactly what you were saying, figuring out how you can, you know, do activities and stay active and try to keep yourself healthy and, you know, mentally well, trying to exercise and do things in your house. So in California, as far as the last time I looked, so the majority of the large, you know, cities like LA, you know, San Diego, San Francisco, I think all of their schools are distance learning at least until the end of the year.
Yeah.
They haven't decided, you know, up in our rural area yet, whether or not, you know, kids will be going back to school or doing distance learning. But yeah, that is a hard one, man.
You know, the thing that I'm more concerned about is the socialization part of things, the in-person time, like all these like social cues you get. I mean, luckily for kids right now, my daughter is very into Minecraft. So, and any parent will tell you right now that they're letting their kids have way more time on devices, partly because there is a social aspect of you know, there's a couple different games. For that age group, my daughter's 9 now. So, and then with you know, older teenagers, there are a lot of games where you work as a team, or there's sports games where you're sort of, you know, working together, or you're managing the team or whatever. And I feel like that at least gives them this social interaction, because, you know, my son Phoenix is like, there are times where he just gets, you know, he's pretty good at, you know, relaying this information to me, but he just gets to a certain point where he's, you know, clearly lonely or just missing that social thing. Last week I had a Zoom call with a bunch of friends of mine. We've been doing this Thursday evening Zoom call regularly, and he basically hung out in here with us the whole time.
That's cool.
Because he knows most of them now, and they kind of liked engaging him now that he's older, and you know, like, you know, they can kind of get away with saying just about anything now, and he's okay with it. But he, you know, afterwards I said, you know, did you have fun? He's like, yeah, I just, you know, I missed, you know, talking to people like that. He's very social in that way. So, you know, that's one of my bigger concerns, is how to do that. And, you know, one of my questions, I guess, for you is there a point at which we take the risk of, and are we there yet, or do you think this is down the line still, of letting kids play together masked? You know, I mean, if we're not going to go to school, do we bring the risk down a lot by just having, like, you know, one close friend who's able to play together, or is that still too much of a risk?
Yeah, I mean, that is a great question. That is a great question. And I feel like I could speak on both sides of it.
Yeah.
But I think you could easily, you know, make some smart precautionary decisions.
Yeah.
You know, wearing masks, maybe having a really small group of people.
Yeah.
And especially if, say, we were able to get these home tests going, I think that would make it a whole lot easier to feel safer to have kids hang out.
That's true. That's true.
You know, I would say, you know, the younger kids, it's interesting because I would say the younger kids actually are safer to hang out as opposed to the older kids.
Yeah.
And so they kind of showed this, I guess, Israel was one of the countries that tried to get their schools to go back sooner. And they had some trouble with, you know, viral spread, especially kind of in the older kids. And this, you know, this viral, the coronavirus is interesting and different because most of the time, you know, when I see a sick adult or a kid, you know, before all this time, you know, happened, the first thing I would ask is, oh, are your kids in daycare? Because most of the time when people get sick and have kids, it's usually spread through daycare. But the interesting thing is that this virus does not seem to be spread as often from kids to adults. Hmm. And so, yeah, it's kind of an interesting thing. But so I would say, you know, you could probably make some some safe decisions and having super small, maybe just like one or two kids hanging out, you know, wearing masks. And especially if we had these home tests and you could, you know, do the test every day, that would just make things a whole lot different, a whole lot safer.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that makes sense. We haven't yet, you know, we've luckily, because we've been able to do some outside stuff. So we've like gone for bike rides with friends and we've done some stuff in, you know, in the backyard where they can like run around and hula hoops and jump ropes, just like anything that we can, you know, have where they can do independent things, or even play tennis. Like, you know, Phoenix is playing with his friend, just to be outside and, you know, have some socialization. But like I said, like I'm concerned about what that does to them in the winter months when they can't have that in-person time.
Absolutely. So, and just like think about how much energy we get from other people too.
I know.
I mean, you know, depending on, of course, you know, introvert, extrovert, that sort of thing. But even say us introverts, and I'm a hardcore introvert, as you know.
Yeah.
Like even still, spending a lot of time by yourself, you know, can be detrimental, and you really need to be around people, especially in the winter in Minnesota when it can be brutal. And sometimes you just need to be like hanging out with your friends and family or people you love, and be able to just like get through the winter together. So I can totally see how that would be challenging. You know, one thought I was just thinking about, I've been really wanting to do an indoor garden in my place for a really long time.
Yeah.
And I think that could be a really cool thing to have, like, you know, either plants or vegetables or something like growing in your house, and then having your kids be able to take care of it, and then be able to kind of like, you know, see the process and a learning, and also see, you know, like how to eat better, all those types of things. I think that could be an interesting, you know, project, or little projects like that where you could get the whole family to kind of like work together on building something or, you know, growing something. I think that'd be cool.
Yeah. And it's educational, but we do a little outdoor garden right now. And, you know, that's part of the reason that our kids eat vegetables, is because we've done that for a while. And, you know, they get very excited when you see the cucumber, you know, finally get to size and you get to pick it, and the tomatoes and that kind of stuff. They get excited to eat the stuff.
Yeah, that's awesome.
I have a series of questions. I want to try to go through some things a little bit, you know, faster, because there's like so many different questions, and some of these might seem a little silly, because but these are just things that I've pulled off the internet where there are some people who take this very seriously, and I don't want to demean that, because it's, you know, for you and I who are in this all the time, like we have a pretty good sense of this, you know, stuff, but not everybody does. And, you know, like take something like, you know, weather. People were saying at the beginning of this that, when the weather gets warmer, the virus should be weakened. Is that true?
Well, so that's, you know, kind of the theory, and it's a little hard to tease out with the data. It does appear that is somewhat true, but at the same time, you know, people still weren't really like following the mask order, the social distancing and that sort of thing. And so although maybe it had gone down a little bit, you know, people were still spreading it. So we probably won't know, you know, the seasonality of that or the change in weather, you know, until probably next year when we're retrospectively looking at all the data.
And then, the other part of it is, if the virus is being dispersed outside, most of it's actually happening indoors anyway. And so you have, you know, places like the Sun Belt in the U.S. now that's like just getting ravaged. And part of it is because people are actually spending most of their time indoors because it's so hot in the South. And in some places like Arizona, they've had a really hot summer. So then you're indoors and people are going to take more risks at some point, especially younger people.
Yeah, exactly. And so I think, you know, less about the seasonality of the virus and more about the human behavior. And so, you know, and you're spot on. I mean, it's been hot up here too. I mean, when I was in Redding for grocery shopping last weekend, it was like 114 or something. Oof. And so, so people stay, you know, when people are inside more, both, you know, with their family, but also social gatherings, you know, that's why when they started opening the bars and that sort of thing, you saw another big spike, and why they had to close everything down again. And so I think less about the seasonality of the virus and more about, you know, human behavior and how, you know, in the winter months and in the summer months, especially in the South, where people are inside all the time. Here's another interesting, you know, thing. So at first we thought it was only spread by respiratory droplets, basically, you know, if you're, you know, coughing or sneezing. But the other thing is, even just talking, you know, spits out enough respiratory droplets that just like having a regular conversation at a regular distance with a person, you could easily infect someone.
Yeah.
So that's one thing. But then I guess there were like 200, you know, scientists around the world that were urging the World Health Organization to basically add on that it is also spread by aerosolized. And I guess the WHO and the CDC finally agreed that that's possible. So what that means is that it can spread in smaller droplets that can hang in the air for longer. So imagine living in, say, like an apartment building or an office building. Yeah. And someone is by a vent or something like that and coughs, could it theoretically spread to someone else through the vents? It appears that that's
possible. Yeah, I think they proved it someplace in Korea or China somewhere where they there was a building where people were getting it up and down one line of the building.
Right.
And so I think that was where some of the evidence came from. But yeah, that's pretty interesting. So what about drinking alcohol in relation to COVID? Some people have claimed that that will protect you. And I know that alcohol consumption has gone up considerably during this time period. But can it protect you?
Well, I mean, so I think the English prime minister or whatever made some comment about how, well, if alcohol is in hand sanitizer, then we should all basically just be drinking the whole time because then that will protect us.
Like the disinfectant in the body, right?
Yeah, exactly. And you're spot on. I think alcohol actually consumption has gone up a significant amount. One of my patients, her son is the director of some winery in Napa, and this has been their best quarter of all time.
And that's surprising.
So it's just kind of crazy, you know. So I could probably go on both sides of this one, and probably, you know, could come up with some compelling, you know, reasoning on both sides. But I would say, so I think, you know, again, and just like everything else, moderation. And I think, you know, the alcohol, I don't think it's necessarily going to prevent the virus necessarily, you know, like help you if you get it. But at the same time, I think, you know, the calming effect or being able to say like have a drink or two, you know, like at night with your family to kind of decompress as long as you don't go crazy, you know. But I, you know, I would have a hard time believing or telling patients that it's a good idea to drink to prevent the virus.
Right. And you know, and not in moderation means you're going to dehydrate yourself and work against, you know, your sense of well-being, and you don't sleep as well. You know, I mean, that for most people. And, you know, I think that was sort of proven in some of those studies that in that Matthew Walker book, you know, that it basically wakes you up a lot of times, like
That's been proven over and over, and it sounds like for most people that basically it's anywhere from zero to two drinks is okay. But for most people, more than that, it absolutely significantly disrupts sleep.
Yeah. What about hydroxychloroquine?
Yeah.
I've seen a lot this week. Like, you know, I saw something about the Brazil study, and I saw two different, completely different articles with the same information. I mean, but actually the information wasn't even the same. The statistics were different. So,
yeah, I mean, I feel like that topic is just so politicized and so challenging because, you know, I think there's some compelling data actually that it could be helpful in certain cases.
Right.
And there are, you know, there are some doctors, especially the doctors who are working, say, in the ICUs and on the front line, are taking low doses of it every day as basically a preventative.
Right.
And so, and then the other thing that's really unfortunate is that there were a couple of big studies that were published in very big journals, I think in The Lancet and the New England Journal of Medicine, that were trying, or that basically were refuting and basically saying hydroxychloroquine doesn't work and it has more, you know, cardiac toxic effects. And then, you know, like a couple of weeks later, it was retracted because the data was like made up. And so it's like, who can you even trust anymore?
Yeah.
It's just like very, I feel like this has been, and I've had this concern for years, especially after, you know, doing research, you know, at the big institution I was at and kind of seeing like how the sausage is made and seeing how like it's so like so easy for people to manipulate data to, you know, to advance their career or advance like a, you know, try to get more grant funding or trying to say like support their boss or trying to support.
Yeah,
like,
supporting the boss is probably a huge one, right? Because you get some pretty big egos in these things where people don't want to like speak out against it.
Yeah. So, you know, one of the biggest things about that was I was in this, this research ethics course, and my best friend in residency was sitting next to me, and he was planning on going on to be like the chairman of a program, you know, and I was planning on going on to maybe start a company. And so the whole thing was basically on how money, you know, can conflict and make people do, you know, bad things in research and make up data and all that kind of stuff. And I raised my hand. I was like, I totally agree with you, but what about basically people's ego and the power of, you know, people quoting your name and, you know, and basically like the ego and the power and that sort of thing. And everyone, it was like silent. No one had even thought about that. That happens all the time. And we're starting to see that more often that people are skewing data or making things up or cause you can take the same data and you can actually like, you can communicate it in a totally different way and use statistics to make something sound either a much bigger deal or not as big of a deal. Like, for example, even the Gilead company that has that medication, you know, remdesivir.
Yeah.
You know, even some of those studies, you know, the way that, say, the company is talking about the same data as opposed to, say, the researchers is different.
Yeah.
So it can be very challenging. And that's why, you know, putting all of this information and having, you know, just kind of general people talk about it and putting it on the news or on the internet and stuff can be very kind of challenging, because you have to understand a lot of the science behind it and the statistics to be able to kind of parse through and see what's actually believable and what's not.
And once, you know, a bad study comes out, or, you know, like a false study comes out, it's hard to refute. You know, like the vaccine thing, you know, that fake study or that falsified information that was in that study, it has affected us for like 12 years now, and trying to convince people, you know, otherwise, that it could actually prevent, you know, all sorts of things, brain health wise, Alzheimer's, different things, you know. And so it's frustrating when that kind of stuff happens, because it's hard to backtrack and sort of disprove it after some percentage of the population has just bought in. Then you have to convince them that's not true now.
For sure. So they talk about how, you know, the initial study will be on the front page of the paper, and then, you know, the retraction will be on the back page, you know, a week later, and no one's going to read that.
Right.
So then basically for, you know, the rest of, you know, history, people will be only like looking at the front page and looking at that. And so, yeah, it makes it very challenging.
Okay. Couple more day-to-day COVID questions for you.
Sure.
One, back to mask for a second. I've seen some things where people have said that masks are not a good idea during exercising. Thoughts on that? Partly because they get wet, and because we're becoming a little oxygen depleted at a certain point if they get wet.
You know, I think the wetness is actually a good idea. You know,
that actually could probably trap
more virus. But so I think the whole working out with a mask thing, it really all depends on where you're, you know, exercising in and how likely it is that you're going to be running past someone or, you know, going past someone, that sort of thing. I mean, I don't think it's that big of a deal, you know, oxygen wise. And there's been some at least anecdotal evidence, you know, of people basically showing, you know, like running with N95s and all that type of stuff, and their oxygen levels don't necessarily go down.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah.
All right, that's a good one. And then as far as surface contact is concerned, how concerned should we be with that kind of thing? I mean, I've seen people, you know, who get to the extreme of, you know, as soon as they get home, you know, they clean their shoes, they, you know, put their clothes in the dryer, or have certain clothes that they just throw away. And, you know, is that something, or, you know, getting products shipped from China? This is the other one that people are concerned about that I've seen.
Yeah. So it's definitely possible that the virus can, you know, live for a period of time on a surface. I think there's debate on how long and how like clinically important that is. But again, a lot of it is on viral load.
Right. That's what I'm thinking too.
Yeah. So, you know, so this is another good opportunity to talk about masks and stuff too.
Yeah.
So, you know, the mask is super important, you know, not only to prevent the respiratory droplets back and forth, but the other thing that you don't think about is it's preventing you from touching your face. right? From touching your nose and that sort of thing. And so, but the other thing for people who don't wear glasses, you know, the virus can get in through your eyes too, because your eyes are a mucosal layer as well. And so, you know, from, so if you were say someone like, you know, coughed a bunch of, you know, mucus onto a surface, and then like right away you put your hand in it and touched your, you know, face or your eyes, could you theoretically get infected that way? Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
But I mean, I think that would be much less likely. And, you know, the main, I think that would be less likely, but it would be possible.
But I'd be like surfaces, you know, I've noticed, you know, I feel very aware in stores right now, mostly like Target or someplace, where if you touch something or decide not to take it, is that problematic? You know, if you like, they've closed dressing rooms in places because they don't want people trying on clothes and then putting them back, or, you know, being in those rooms and having to clean the rooms. I guess I'm just wondering at this point. I haven't seen enough. Yeah, I'm sure we can. I'm sure we can get exposed to it still, but I'm just wondering. I haven't seen enough data yet that's showing that the amount of viral load that we would get from surfaces, the risks are there.
Yeah, you know, again, I think that would be possible, but super unlikely.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I think it's always good to come back to kind of common sense with a lot of this stuff too, and not try to get too crazy. You know, I mean, again, back to the beginning where, you know, if people want to, you know, really protect their family members and wash their clothes when they get home and, you know, wipe everything down, I think that's fine if they want to do that.
Yeah.
I think it might be a little overkill. But, you know, the main thing would be, say you do go into Target and you touch a bunch of stuff, you know, you should be having your mask on the whole time. And then when you leave, just washing your hands. I mean, I think, you know, the common sense approach and doing it that way, I think would be more than sufficient.
Yeah, simple. But we don't have to worry about getting it from products from China.
No, I think that would be very, very unlikely. Okay. Extremely unlikely.
Oh, I think we got through just about everything that I have on here. Is there anything else that you're still, you know, trying to resolve?
Well, so let me end with this one, and maybe it's not the brightest case, but hopefully this will maybe encourage people to take this, you know, even more seriously and wear their masks and that sort of thing. So because this has been going on for a while, we're starting to see some studies pop up of people who have had the virus and are recovered. So there was a study I presented at last week's meeting from Italy, and they basically showed that after like 2 to 3 months after someone recovered, 88% of people were still having multiple symptoms related to the coronavirus.
Yes.
So even if you say like get through it and you recover, like you're still having symptoms. And so this is still a huge deal. And I mean, just taking, you know, common sense approaches, wearing the mask, socially distancing, you know, washing your hands and just trying to be smart about decision making. I mean, when I, you know, was presenting this case and doing the research and stuff, I was like, geez, like this is still a really big deal.
And then you just reminded me of one other question that I have. So in terms of, you know, developing antibodies, because generally speaking, you know, with herd immunity, in most cases, once we have something, we're immune for, you know, a period of time. And then don't these viruses kind of like change over time or just become weakened as strains, as RNA? And then if we develop antibodies, how long do we hold on to them?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think it would be hard to answer that 100%. It seems like on a lot of the testing that after 2 to 3 months, a lot of the antibodies are gone.
Okay.
And so we don't necessarily know, you know, whether or not people can get reinfected and how bad those reinfections, you know, possibly could be, or whether or not the virus, you know, if it were still, you know, replicating and spreading through population, could it mutate and then basically people, you know, be reinfected and that sort of thing? I mean, it's definitely possible. I think a lot of those questions are still totally unanswered and a lot of people are looking at that, but it would be hard to answer.
Yeah. And we are dealing with that all the time with other coronaviruses. I mean, right. I mean, this is common.
That's the interesting thing. Yeah. That's the interesting thing. I mean, there are multiple coronaviruses, and actually one of the most common causes of the common cold every single year is a coronavirus. Yeah. And it mutates, you know, there's thousands of strains of it in different ways. So basically, you know, if you think about the, you know, RNA, you know, it's similar to DNA in a way, but basically just think about RNA as basically like the instruction manual of this organization yeah. or of this organism yeah. and basically on how it behaves. So basically those instructions can just continually change as it adapts and as it basically learns how to evade the human immune system. And so it's definitely possible for it to continue to mutate for sure.
Because I think, I don't remember if you and I talked about this or something else that I've heard, but that the thing about this virus that is so unique to viruses is that most of the time they can either spread really easily or I forget what the other thing is now. There's two aspects. What's the other part of it? I'm forgetting.
Yep. So basically, most of the time with viral disorders like this, it's either it spreads super easily and it's not super deadly.
Yeah.
Or it doesn't spread very easily and it's super deadly.
Yeah.
So the way to think about this is the current coronavirus versus Ebola.
Right. Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so, and even with some of the viruses that we had in the last 10 years, there's been some deadly ones, but they just haven't been able to jump very easily between people. And
exactly.
and this one is just seems to have that mastered.
And a big part of that too is because people can have a huge viral load and be spreading the virus and have no symptoms at all.
Yeah. Well, on that note.
Please, everyone, be smart and wear your masks and, you know, do it for the people you love just so we can get through this together and not have to spend another, you know, winter, you know, by ourselves in our homes and not like at the bars.
Yeah. I mean, that's the thing I wanted to talk about today, too, is just I want people to take it seriously. But I also I think there are ways to be smart here and to really look at, you know, the way this works, the anatomy of this, you know, the situation. I think we can, once we have that down a little bit more, I mean, I still hear people saying things that I realize that they don't quite get this yet. Or I see, you know, Facebook threads or different kinds of things where I tend to never jump in on those things. But there are some times when I feel like I have to take the time with people and say, no, you know, like, I don't want this to disseminate, you know, through this thread. And it's a very simple thing. And most of the time, it's interesting, if you address people the right way, you know, don't call them an idiot right out of the box. They're interested that you know, you're trying to teach them something. And of course, there's going to be people who just don't care, but or who think it's a political thing, you know. But I'm just trying to kind of give people as much of the information as possible.
Yeah, and that's how I try to do it with my patients too. And I've found that a lot, you know, when people come in and they're really, you know, ask questions and really listen. And I really try to give common sense advice and just like very just straightforward common sense, you know, without any political bent or, you know, anything too complicated. Yeah. And in some ways, I feel like that can really reduce people's anxiety if you kind of understand things at a high level and can just think about things in common sense, just so it's not as, you know, scary.
Yeah, agreed. That's why I wanted to go through this with you again. I think I just sense, you know, a high level of anxiety right now with so many people. And, you know, there's lots of reasons for it. It's, you know, some of it is economic and not having any sense of what the future looks like. But I'm just trying to, as much as possible, when I'm working with people, get them to think about what they're working on right now today and what the, you know, what the reality is, and a little bit of preparation. Like, I think, you know, thinking ahead and realizing that we're going to be in this for a little while. I think if we can accept that on some level and not, you know, jump back and forth between, oh, we're going to be free of this. No, we're never going to be free of this kind of feeling. You know, I think that's causing a lot of undue stress.
Absolutely.
Well, thanks so much, man. This is very helpful. And I really appreciate you taking the time and doing this at the end of your day.
Oh my gosh, my pleasure.
Dr. Aaron Babb, folks. That's about as much fun as you can have, I guess, talking about COVID. I hope that was helpful. I hope you got some information that's going to help you organize yourself and hopefully manage some of the stress and anxiety that's going on around this. Let me know what you thought of this topic and conversation. You can always reach me at jeremy@highway2.health. And if you could do me a favor, we're putting more effort into our outreach with this project. So if you think that there's somebody who might benefit from hearing this conversation, please, I would really recommend sharing it, both to help them and to keep us all on the same page here. Thanks for listening and for all that you do. Be good to yourself, be kind to each other, and take care of your planet. Be well, my friends.